So as Stefan said, we're in Acts looking at this sermon that Paul preaches in chapter 13, which is sort of an example, more than likely, of every sermon that he came and started with when he would come into an area to start preaching the gospel, and he would start in a synagogue, and he would start with some of the history that was familiar to the people who had already started worshiping God. And so we've been looking at the history, and he's talking in specific about how sort of a line of succession or how their leadership as a country points to Jesus. And to fill in some of the stuff leading up to this passage, he says that God had various judges that he would raise up as leaders. In other words, God would raise up different people. And then he gets to Samuel, the prophet. And that, there was something that was a little bit different with Samuel or with the story. And we haven't looked at it, so I'll just sort of start there in sort of the background history. What happened was Samuel's mother couldn't have a child. The situation was really distressing to her. She prayed to God in the temple. She was so distressed that Eli, who was the person that was in charge of Israel at that time, the high priest, thought she was drunk. In other words, it's a story where he looked at and his impression or his interpretation of what was going on in this situation was actually just completely off, which we'll get to in this story too when God reminds Samuel that he doesn't look at appearances, because that's what happens a lot of times. We make judgments on people. We say things like, oh, she's drunk or something, but that wasn't it. She was just full of hurt right then. And so God gave her a child, and she had said, look, I'm going to give this child back to you as a small child. We're not sure what age, but young. She let Samuel, her son, stay with Eli, the priest, in the temple to help him out serving the Lord there. Eli was getting old, and he started to allow his sons to sort of have that succession of authority. He was in charge. He started to let his sons sort of take over. In other words, there's this thought that, you know, if you can have a succession like that, that it'll stay, you know, on track. There won't be turmoil and that, and we're going to sort of establish it by this line of people, which is important because the passage brings up this idea of the succession of authority or things going well being passed externally by like our kids or another, that type of thing. Well, it turns out his kids were evil and it didn't go so well. And their end result was they ended up fighting a battle with the Philistines, and they went out to offer the sacrifice to that, and the battle was lost and his sons were killed. And when Eli heard of it, he fell off his stool and he died. And so what's interesting is this little kid, Samuel, a little bit older then, he now takes over. So you can see how there's this thing in the succession of this wanting to lay out this path of consistency and security, but our sinfulness sort of throws a wrench in it and God pulls someone else in. And then with Samuel, the same thing happened. When he got older, he tried to have his sons carry on that succession. And same problem as Eli, his sons were evil too, and it didn't work out. And so Israel decided, well, we need to figure out what's wrong with this. We've tried this twice, it hasn't worked out. We feel like the problem is that maybe it's the type of ruler or government we need to have, and we need to maybe establish a king. And of course, Samuel got sort of disgruntled about it, but God says, what, this isn't about you. You know, the reason why you're feeling disgruntled is because you're taking affront at you. But this, what's the problem here isn't about you. It's that they're actually rejecting me from being king over them. And so God then establishes a new throne. Even though it was a bad idea and it was him, the country, rejecting God, he established Saul as king over them. And Saul had the same intention of having his sons rule after him. In other words, there's this continuous idea coming up of having this consistency by the external or physical side of us doing things. Saul messed up, though, and God said, no, the comfort, the security that everyone's looking for. It's not going to happen in your line, but I'm going to choose someone else. And the whole point of why Paul's bringing this up is he's going to say, it's not through the Solomon, the son of David, and then his son. It's actually because God was about to bring Jesus, and it's all pointing to the promise of Jesus. But what is it that's happening there in the context? You can see it a little bit clearer with Saul and what the problem is. It's not that all our kids are evil and we're good. I know sometimes, no, I'm just teasing. You know, it's not a generational thing that one generation is good and one is bad. We kind of think that way. The problem came home with Saul, that the problem was with him. And what happened with Saul is that he knew that they needed God with them. He cared about God. He had a relationship with God. He had faith in God. It says, Stefan brought up that when Samuel died and was within heaven and he came back to talk to Saul, he said, look, you're going to die and you'll be with me. So wherever Samuel is after death, that's where Saul's going to be. It's not that Saul's not going to heaven, but it's there was something that was happening here on earth that the promise of Jesus had an effect on that he was missing. And the problem was is that he was supposed to wait for Samuel to come and offer this sacrifice, and the sacrifice keeps coming up here in the passage. So we'll just hit it now. What the sacrifice is, it's this point in time, it's like a tradition that they had, but the point of the tradition was to take a moment before you start your year or before you start this battle or whatever, to just sort of take a moment and recognize whatever it is that's good that I want to see happen, I'm just not going to get that on my own. It's going to require some other way. And that the result of my actions and the things that I'm doing is really going to be the opposite of where I want to go. And the sacrifice is a way of turning and saying to God, is there some other way of getting there? Is there some other way of this being taken care of? And the problem with Saul is that he didn't wait. He just sort of decided, well, this is, I know that this is, we need God with us and that this needs to happen and this is something that I can do. And so he just offered the sacrifice himself. And that was sort of the parting ways with him and God in terms of God saying, look, this isn't accurate description of the promise of Jesus. Now, what's going on with that? What's happening here, and God brings up the heart here in a minute, is he's getting at that there's been this history of people like Saul or us where we sort of recognize we need God in our lives, but then we start thinking through what's my part and what do I need to do? And we start to do a bunch of things. We start to make assumptions about stuff. We start to make judgments about stuff. And we set our heart then on what we need to do to make this happen and what we need to do to get this going. And he says that's one way that we can move our heart. But he said another way, the way that he's looking for, that points to the promise of Jesus, is to say, God, what are you going to do? And how are you going to work through this? And how can I be with you in this process? And there's really a decision that happens in our heart on what do we want to dwell on? Do we want to dwell on what am I going to do to change this? What am I going to do to make this happen? What do I need to do to the, or are we going to be thinking in our heart, God, what are you doing? How are you going to save me? How do you fit into that? And he's saying that that difference of heart makes a difference in our life. And that's where the story starts off today. It says, now the Lord said to Samuel, how long will you grieve over Saul since I have rejected him from being king over Israel? Fill your horn with oil, and I will send you to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have selected a king for myself among his sons. But Samuel said, how can I go? When Saul hears of it, he will kill me. And the Lord said, take a heifer with you and say, I have come to sacrifice to the Lord, and you shall invite Jesse to the sacrifice, and I will show you what you shall do, and you shall anoint for me the one whom I designated to you. So when it says that Samuel was grieving over Saul, what it doesn't say is that about 20 years had passed And so he's been grieving for about 20 years. And God's basically coming to him saying, how much longer is this going to be the case? You know, I told you 20 years ago that I was going to solve this problem by picking someone. And yet you spent the past 20 years, instead of thinking about that promise that I gave, which is pointing to the promise of Jesus, you've just been grieving over this situation. And he's asking him that question because he's kind of saying to him, you really don't need to be here. And you've obviously found some sort of joy in being here, but so you're there, and I've just let you be there for 20 years. But I'm coming to ask, do you still just want to be here in this place of grieving? What it's saying is that when we set our heart on what do I need to do, how can I fix this situation, what can I do, the end result of that is always going to be situations that we're going to end up grieving over because we're going to end up failing. And that's the way it had been if you looked at their history over and over again. And he's not diminishing the fact that, you know, Samuel felt hurt by Saul, or that Saul had, you know, not done something wrong, or there aren't consequences, or this or that. He's just saying, look, the end result of our actions is going to be this situation where we are justified in feeling grieved and feeling hurt. But he's saying, because of the promise of Jesus, the promise that he had given 20 years earlier, the promise that he would choose someone, that he's explaining to him the promise of Jesus, because of this promise, even though you're completely justified in being here in this grief, you don't have to stay there if you don't want to. In other words, there's something about this promise that allows you to move from this situation of grief and hurt, and it's ongoing. Nothing's changed with Saul. He says, if Saul feels threatened by me, even though we have a, you know, there's a lot of love between Samuel and Saul, when Saul, the chips are down at the end, the person that he looks for is Samuel. But even though there's that love, that relationship's there, when he feels threatened, Samuel knows, you know, Saul will just kill me off. Even though the situation hasn't changed, even though there's lots of reasons to feel hurt, even though there's very justifiable reasons to feel grieved, God said, given all that, you really didn't need to spend the past 20 years there if you didn't want to, because I gave you the promise of Jesus, and that could have changed things. And so what the question is how is it that what is the promise of Jesus, and how is it that the promise of Jesus can allow us to live a life where there's reasons to be grieved, reasons to be disappointed, reasons to feel hurt, very real reasons that aren't changing, but we don't have to live in that. We can let go of it. And the reason why is the promise of Jesus is this, that we're not going to get to the place that we need to get to. No one else is going to get there too. The end result of that is going to be frustration, grieving, and all of that. And it's not just what everyone else is doing to you. It's what we do ourselves to each other. The guilt is, there's enough guilt to go all the way around on all that. But whatever the case is, that's where we should be, is just in this place of frustration and grief, lashing out, you know, as Saul would have done, even feeling threatened. That's where we would be, justifiably. But the question is God able to give us the life that we want and the joy that he has for us in spite of all that? And that's why Paul talks about Jesus' death, that he's talking to the group of people there, the church, had killed Jesus, basically, is what he's saying. He's saying, look, Jesus came and we did everything we could to cause grief, all of our actions were pinnacled here to the point of actually killing Jesus off, and he's in the ground for 3 days, and yet that didn't stop God at all, because God just raised him from the dead. Now, what does that mean? He's saying, here's some things that if you hold to this as fact in faith, it'll change something for you here on earth. It'll change something in your heart. And how does it affect things? Because if that's true, that God is able to accomplish his plans and his love for us in spite of the fact that we keep messing things up, then what that does is it allows us the freedom to not sit there and nitpick and grieve and feel threatened and all this by all this that's going on that's a result of our human action. We can, that's all there, and there's consequences and all that business. I'm not saying that none of it's important. It's all there. It's all important. But the end result of it all is just grief. And he's just saying, you don't have to dwell there if you don't want to. If you believe that God's able to accomplish what he wants to accomplish in spite of all that. The promise of Jesus is that the consequences and the results for all of this grief, the things that justifiably, the need, you may feel like, well, no, I need to be there because there's consequences. All those consequences, he's saying, have fallen on Jesus. That he came down and he was the sacrifice for us. In other words, what that means is that God became one of us, and everything that should befall us because of all the mistakes that everyone and ourselves have made, the consequences of all that, he's saying, I'm taking that on myself. What needed to happen in terms of the good that we should have done, that's the story of Jesus too, saying that, look, whatever we really did need to accomplish in order to have what we want, the joy, the life, whatever it is that we want, whatever needed to happen, we weren't able to do. There's consequences. Jesus bore those consequences, and the promise of Jesus is he also did on our behalf whatever it is that needed to get done. In other words, you may think, I got to do A, B, and C, and D to be able to get to this place over here. And then you realize, well, that all got messed up, and so now there's consequences. Jesus came and says, the promise of Jesus is, I'm going to take all those consequences on myself. And whatever it is that needed to happen here, I'm going to do it. So now you're no longer have to dwell in that area. What he's saying is that there's some, if we look at what the promise of Jesus is about and look at this gospel message, it's not just about what's going to happen in heaven. That is there. It's a hope for heaven. But it also changes things here on earth because it changes the way that we look at things and the way we evaluate things. It changes our hope in what's going to happen. And if we're sitting there thinking, what am I going to do and how am I going to do this and who needs to do this and this person needs to treat me like this and that person needs to treat me and I need to treat, and I, me, the end result of all that, yourself included, is just going to be grief and fear and threatening. But if you see that in spite of us messing up, God's able to give us freely, and that he's justified in it, that there's no reason why God is now bound to give us this, that if Jesus paid the price, then Jesus has done it and Jesus has earned it, then he can give it to us freely. If you believe that, then it allows you to just say, I can just let go of this right now. So the first way that the promise of Jesus, if it's true, saves us, not just in heaven, but here on earth, is that it allows us to have the freedom to walk away from some of the hurt that's there in life. And that's not to diminish the hurt. That's not to say the hurt isn't real. That's not to say that your guilt isn't real, that someone else is guilty. But he's just saying it's like a prisoner of war type thing. You can be there, but you don't have to live there type thing. And the reason why you don't have to live there is you have other facts now to look at that give you an escape from this. Because the reason why you felt like you had to be there before is because you felt like something had to change, or I had to do this, or someone else had to do that, that something had to get fixed over here in order for it. And so I have to stay here in this state of worry and this and this, and I can't leave this because it has to have something to do with someone, me or someone else getting something fixed. He says, no, if Jesus did it all, and God can do it in spite of all of us doing, then you can just stay over here. And what the over here means, waiting to see what God's doing. You know, listening to what God has said, where he says he's going. There's things that he had told Samuel before of what he was going to do. And as all Samuel had to do is he could have just been waiting. in joy and anticipation to what God was about to do. And it would have been 20 years, but that would have been a 20 years of waiting is better than 20 years of grieving. Now, what he points him to is the sacrifice. He says, you can offer the sacrifice, Lord. We talked about that, how that points to Jesus. And it says Samuel did what the Lord said. In other words, he made that transition. You know, what for his part, what was his part? His part was to make that transition in his heart, to stop grieving about all the mistakes of him and everyone else, and instead to just live on that hope of what God might do in spite of all that. And he just made that choice then. And he moved on. And he started making actions in accordance with that hope, a hope that's lined up with, well, what is God going to do then? Given this, and that this isn't going to change, and that Saul's still trying to kill me, given all that, what's God going to do? It's not just a change of actions, it's a change in his heart that happened. And it says, he came to Bethlehem to the elders of the city, and the elders of the city came trembling to meet him and said, do you come in peace? Trembling, it's not like they were just faking it to show deference or something like that. The word there is like they were afraid. In other words, they weren't afraid of Samuel. He wasn't in charge anymore, but they knew there was tension. They knew that they had asked for a king, and the king that they had asked for had messed up, that there was guilt on their side. In other words, they understood that there was some messed up stuff going on, and they were afraid that Samuel, as God's representative, that as God came to this messed up situation, that he obviously wasn't going to be coming in peace. And so they were a little bit fearful, justifiably. They're basically asking God, admitting, this is a messed up situation over here. If you come into this situation as the promise of Jesus saying God stepping in and becoming humanity, what does that mean for us? Are you coming in peace even though we're all messed up? And Samuel says, in peace I have come. And then he says why he has come in peace. I have come to sacrifice to the Lord. Consecrate yourselves and come to me to the sacrifice. Which he also consecrated Jesse and his sons and invited them to the sacrifice. He's saying the reason why we can live in this other side of things is because of this idea of sacrifice or the atonement for our sins or this consecration. What does all that mean? It just means that we would like to be able to come to this place and have deserved it and have done all the right things, but that hasn't happened and we're all messed up and we're all here. And yet we know God is here. So what is God doing when he comes? He says the promise is that when God comes, he will make it so that all the consequences will fall on him and everything that we need to do on our part to live over here, he's going to do it for us. So now we can actually live over here and be as though we did deserve it, even though we didn't deserve it. Does that make sense? That's what consecrated means. It means that God's treating us. It's like if someone is, say a family member is really mean to you. You know, it's holiday season. Family members love to be mean on holidays. I don't know why. It's just a fun thing for families. And so, you know, you have your Christmas tradition and everyone's kind of mean to each other and you're feeling kind of hurt. And so you should be able to, like, enjoy Christmas together, but you can't because, you know, you've all hurt each other and stuff like that. Well, what he's saying is that actually if there was forgiveness, and you say, well, forgiveness, you know, they would need to change. You know, I mean, they've asked for forgiveness, but then every holidays we do the same thing. I mean, there's just no change. Well, if all that was just taken out of the equation somehow, miraculously, then you could enjoy Christmas even though you don't enjoy. That's what he's saying is we can enjoy this here. And it's happening when I come, we can enjoy being together. But the reason is because you're forgiven. Now, he talks about that a little bit more. He says, when they entered, he looked at Eliab and thought in his heart, in other words, he's making decisions. Surely the anointed is before me. And the Lord said to Samuel, do not look at his appearance or at the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For the Lord sees not as man sees, for man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. I know this is a bad example, but I'm going to say it anyways because I just couldn't think of another example this week. And it just kept going. I was going to show a little slide of it's that book, Moneyball, and I was going to show this little YouTube clip of it, even though I wasn't sure that we were allowed to show you, but I think we are allowed to show. But then I realized, oh, there's a lot more being said here that I don't think I can really show this in church. And I don't remember that in the book. Anyways, it's this place, I'm going to just stick on the book. It's this place in the book where all the talent scouts are talking about different players that they're going to pick and why they're going to pick them and stuff like that. And they start talking about this one guy and they start talking about his different skills. And then one of the older scouts says, he's got an ugly girlfriend. And one of the younger, what's that mean? Well, that means he's got a lack of confidence. You got to have lack of confidence. And then they start going on and on and on. And it's like, oh, she's a six or something. It's just like, it's this weird thing where they feel like they're logically making decisions. But what does that have to do with anything? That's what God's saying is everyone down here, we all feel like, oh, we've got all these facts and we see everything the way they is and we see how it all relates. He says, we're just making stupid decisions, very logical decisions. We're very logically moving on from illogical appearances and bases and judgments that we're making on things. He says, the reality is, part of the problem is we think that we're the generation that sees the facts and that we're moving on, that we're the people who see the facts and we're moving on, but that's really not what's happening. We're just making generalizations based on appearances that oftentimes, he's obviously saying, doesn't really work that well, and that's why you looked at this situation and decided that this guy was tall or something like that, and so he would make a great, even though that has nothing to do with anything. But he says God doesn't see things that way, and he looks at the heart. And in other words, there's part of what's being said here of him saying, look, we really, not only are we incapable of doing the right thing, but part of the problem is that the way we look at the world around us and feel so confident that we see things correctly and that we're able to make very logical decisions, that's just completely faulty in every aspect of the word. But God actually sees what's going on. And God's capable of making decisions on what's going on. And God's capable of following through. And we're just failing every aspect of that. But when he brings up the heart, he's bringing something else up. He's saying, look, there's one aspect of things working out, but then you have to ask yourself, to what end? In other words, you know, we want this and this and this to happen so that we can, but to what end do we want? You know, I want to go to school, I want to work hard so that I can get a great job, but to what end? You know, I want to meet the right person so I can get married and have this and, you know, do this as, but to what end? He says the end has to do with the heart. And he said he's looking for someone, as Paul brings up, God says about David that it's a man after his own heart. What does that mean, man after his own heart? It doesn't mean that David never messed up. David messed up all the time. What it means is that David wanted to do this with God, and God wanted to do it with him. In other words, we keep talking about what's our part, and I need to do this, and I need to get this squared out, and I need to, I. But to what end? We thought, one, we're just messing that all up. So, you know, obviously, even if we stayed in that, just that line of thinking is all messed up. And Jesus came to save us from all that because that just results in grief. But even if that was to work out, to what end? He's saying, look, when God created Adam, he had the best job in the world. The world wasn't like polluted. There's all sorts of, but it wasn't good for Adam to be alone. God created the world. He did have all sorts of joy in creating the world and seeing like it's good. But to what end? God says, look, the greater joy isn't me doing this and this and this and this and that, and me getting this and this and this and right, and being able to feel this sense of accomplishment, and I put the puzzle together, and I was the one who figured out the last piece. And I mean, that all feels good. But he says, to what end? The fact that you sat there and did a puzzle together is to what end? In other words, that sense of just being together is what it's about. That what God enjoys, and the reason why he's going through all this is he had the joy of creating everything, but he's going through all this excruciating mess and becoming, sending his son down to die on the cross. To what end? Because God feels like the best joy in the world is being with us. And he's saying that's part of what's lost. Is it's not just letting go for my own personal sake, but it's letting go so that I can be with someone else, so that I can have that joy of just not being alone and that joy of being together. What he's saying is the promise of Jesus, it allows us to let go of all the hurt and the responsibility and the weight of everything that we're messing up. But it's not just that. It's the end that means. What that means is if we could let go of all that, then we could actually enjoy being together. And we've been thinking, you know, sometimes I remember when I was in high school and early, I always thought, man, it might be really fun to just leave everyone and go up to Alaska and live in a cabin for the rest of my life and just me and the bears. But then I was watching this Alone special and realized, I don't know, that might not be that much fun. These guys are like there for like 4 days and they're like, we'd be like, I'm not so alone! And I just feel like, really? 4 days? I think I could handle 4 days. And it's not the bears and everything, they're just like feeling so sense of alone. It's like, I don't know, I might be able to just sit in a cave. You know, maybe not. What he's saying is, sure, you feel like you just need to be alone. But that's because being together just sucks so bad sometimes. But if you took all that away and you didn't have to live in all that, then being together would actually be really great. And what he's saying is you can have that joy. Just let go. The reason why you're letting go of this isn't so you can just feel better about yourself. I mean, that might happen. It feels good to feel better about yourself and all that. But the real point of the whole thing is now you can enjoy just being together a little bit. But you're not going to have that joy of being together outside of forgiveness, outside of the promise of Jesus, outside of some sort of hope that God's going to make things good, even though we just keep messing things up. So he's saying the point of Jesus on earth is to, one, allow us to let go of all the hurt and the frustration and the pain that comes from us trying to do our thing. And the end result of that, if we can, in faith, based on Jesus, let go of that and forgive a little bit and just not live there, the end result is hopefully we can just have that joy of just being together. Now, what happens when we have that joy of being together? It says here, next, Jesse made Shammah pass by, and he said, the Lord has not chosen this one either. Thus, Jesse made 7 sons pass before Samuel, but Samuel said to Jesse, the Lord has not chosen these. And Samuel said to Jesse, are these all the children? And he said, there remains yet the youngest. And behold, he is tending the sheep. And then Samuel said to Jesse, send him here, bring him, for we will not sit down until he comes. And so he sent and brought him in. And it says, he was ruddy. Ruddy means like, I'm pretty sure it means like you've got like the kind of skin condition where your skin's sort of, you know, red because it's kind of inflamed. In other words, he's got some problems with his skin, brings that up. And maybe that ruddy is like, you know, an appealing thing. I don't know. It doesn't really say. It just makes a comment about it. But then it says something with beautiful eyes. In other words, you kind of notice there's like, He's got some sort of skin problem. But man, he's really got beautiful eyes. And then he says, and a handsome appearance. I hate that word, handsome. Yeah. I got a daughter that's, you know, went to Italy, and I got this friend, I think I told you guys this, friend from Afghanistan. He's been here about 4 or 5 years now. And he said, he kept talking to me about her, like, leaving before she left. He kept saying, you just need to say no. And I kept saying, well, I didn't know what to say. And he goes, no, I understand America. It's like one of the problems with America is you can't just say no to your kids. And I was like, okay. And then I don't know how to explain all that because he's just going down this road. And then he says, you don't understand. And he's like, looks at me real soon. He goes, the men in Italy are very handsome. And it's like, I hate that word, handsome. And then it's like, okay. And then he just keeps going on. He's not going to be able to move here anymore. It's like painting this picture of like she's going to meet. She's not going to be able to help it. They're so handsome. And now that she's going to have a family over and you're never going to see them for your life is ruined because you couldn't say no because you're a stupid American customs attendant. You know, it's just like. Reason why he's saying, like, handsome, beautiful, he's not saying, like, oh, he's going to be a really great king, he's really going to make things happen because he's got beautiful eyes. What it is this is like the least likely tribe. When people looked out at the appearance of things, this would have been the last tribe that anyone would have thought anything good came from. It's like when Jesus came, some of his disciples said from Nazareth, can anything good come from Nazareth? You know, Galilee, can anything good come from Galilee? It's like the least likely place. Bethlehem, nothing good can come of that. It was the least likely tribe, the least likely family. And of that family, he was the one that everyone just completely overlooked. But what God is saying is like, man, we're going to have a lot of fun hanging out, him and I. What does that mean? It means when we start going down this road of thinking, what's my part? What do I got to do? How do I got to? One of the ways that we mess things up is we just completely overlook people in our life that really would have been the best friend in the entire world. We just look at them. We just don't see it. All we can see is all the reasons why there's not a good fit here, all the reasons why, you know, I don't have anything in common with this person, all the reasons why it shouldn't work out, and we're just sort of dwelling over here on all the reasons why, blah, 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 over here, and we just miss out on the joy of someone that we actually could have really clicked with, and God's saying, I'm not going to miss out on that opportunity, and you don't either, but you got to quit looking at all this stuff. You got to quit evaluating life. And you don't have to. You can dwell there for the next 20 years if you want to. But I'm going to keep coming back to you saying, have you had enough of this already? Like, would you like to have some fun? Would you like to just, I understand that everything's messed up. I understand Saul's mess. I understand. But do you really just want to be there? I mean, you can be there if you want. Stay there. If it feels good, stay there. But I'm just telling you, I think there might be something better if you let go of some of this stuff. And what there is that's better is a hope in Jesus. And the reason why a hope in Jesus makes a difference is because you don't have to look at all the reasons why you're not going to get along. And if you don't, then it opens your eyes to some possibilities of some friendships and some people in your life that you were probably just overlooking before. And I know that maybe we don't see it that we're overlooking, but you often see people are overlooking you for those very same reasons. And it doesn't need to be like that. It does need to be like that if we're the ones that are going to make things happen. But if there's a hope in Jesus, then it doesn't have to be like that. And what's opened up when it says beautiful eyes is once you make that adjustment, and you just start asking, God, what are you going to bring into my life? What people are you going to bring into my life? And even if at first I might have made this stupid judgment based on appearances and just felt like I got nothing together with this person, that's all me just being ridiculous. But if I can set that to the side and see, God brought this person into my life. And it doesn't have to be it works because of what I do, what they do with it, because we're making it work, but it's because God gave it as a gift. It allows us to just relax a little bit, and all of a sudden you may notice, man, this person really has beautiful eyes. You know, this person's actually, you know, pretty handsome type thing. And I'm not like it's, I'm not saying it in a romantic sense of the word, but just in a sense that all of a sudden you'll start seeing that there's actually some really beautiful things about some different people that you just didn't see before. And you'll actually, instead of taking joy in me, I've done this, I got this, I do this, there's a joy in that, but you'll actually see there's some real joy to be found in just being with some people, and all of a sudden, for the first time, noticing, you know, there's some really beautiful things about that person. It's not to say that, like, they're going to be a great leader or they're never going to mess up, or just to say there's some beautiful things about this person. And then what he says, Samuel said to Jesse, bring him here, for we will not sit down until he comes. Says he was ruddy with beautiful eyes and a handsome appearance. And the Lord said, arise, anoint him, for this is he. And then Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the midst of his brothers. And the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon David from that day forward. What he's saying is, I know that we keep thinking we're just going to have all this joy and security and everything else in life, and it's going to come by me recognizing what my point is and what I need to do. And I know we think that, but that's just all messed up. And that just results in grief. But if you can just set that way of thinking aside in your heart, and I know there's a part of your heart that's just going to go there, whatever, but just say, that's not who I'm going to dwell on this other part that's just waiting on God to see what God's going to do. That the result of that, waiting on God and seeing what God's going to do and setting our heart on God, is one, we'll be able to let go of the hurt. Two, we'll stop overlooking all the things that are dividing us up and see that God's put some people into our life, and that will be joyful. That'll be more joyful being able to hang out together than any amount of accomplishment that you think you're getting mistakenly on this other side. There's a real joy in just being together. And not just the joy of just being together, but there's a real joy too that now you can start seeing some of the beauty in your friends and family and the people around you that you just didn't notice before. And not just beauty, but you can also just now start to see what God's doing in this situation. The Spirit of the Lord was on him mightily, and it goes into this next story about David and Goliath. That you'll start taking joy in the really great things that God's doing all around us and that we're participating in. We're going to pray. And maybe as everyone bows your head and closes your eyes, if in your heart you've been feeling like God's moving your heart in this direction and you haven't asked Jesus to be your Savior, and you're still not quite sure what that means, but there's just something in your heart saying yes to that. And if you'd like to make a decision to follow Jesus, go ahead and raise your hand right now, and I'll pray for you. Okay. For those of us that have followed Jesus, or even if you haven't, if you'd just like to set this out of trying to figure out what God's going to do, if you don't know what God's been telling you, Samuel asked. We're going to have some prayer over here. You can come and get some prayer, and it won't be telling you how you need to solve your problems, but really just waiting with you. And you can lift that up to the Lord and just ask him for some help. Let's pray. Lord, we just thank you so much for what you've done and coming here and tying yourself to us by becoming one of us, a human being, to say that whatever happens to us happens to you. We thank you for taking on the burden of all the things that we have done to mess things up. And we also just thank you for doing what it is that needs to get done. We thank you for making things happen in spite of the fact that we keep messing up. Lord, I pray that you'll just keep knocking on our door of our heart and encourage us and just help us this week and this month to really make a transition to let go of some of the pain that's there for us and some of the hurt, And help us to really just grab a hold of that joy of being together with some of the people that you put into our life. And help us to really start seeing the beauty in ourselves and the beauty in some of the people around us. And Lord, help us to also see just the beauty of what it is that you're doing in our lives. We ask this all in your name, Jesus. Amen.